Thank you for listening to the LA Catholic Morning Podcast. To help us broadcast all the good, true, and beautiful, please go to our support page on archangelradio.com.
Time to wake up, Lower Alabama. Ha ha! From the original home of Mardi Gras, moon pies, and more, this is LA Catholic Morning.
Going home to Alabama, all the way to where the ocean meets the road.
Good morning and happy Thanksgiving. On behalf of Archangel Radio, we are certainly thankful for you, all of our listeners and donors, and for your endless support, so that we can continue to bring you all the good, true, and beautiful in the Archdiocese. Before we thank our sponsor, let us pray. Dear God, thank you for this blessed Thanksgiving Day. Thank you for the time that we are spending with family and with friends. May we all be mindful of the blessings we have received living here in the United States and in our world. We pray that you bless and look after all of those in special need on this Thanksgiving Day. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. We thank our LA Catholic Morning sponsor, Spectrum Collision, a family-owned Christian business that believes in the values of hard work and doing things right the first time. Spectrum Collision, proud to be the premier automotive and collision shop in Mobile for over 20 years. Call them at 251-342-0005 and like them on Facebook.
Always look forward to when Dr. Donald Prudlow from the University of Tulsa comes on to speak to us about Catholic history. Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
So this one touches my heart because, ironically, I went to Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio, which is run by the Third Order Regular Franciscans. But there was one, at the time, there was one Dominican priest there, Father Giles Dimmock, who is still an incredible dear friend of mine. He was an incredible professor. He ended up marrying my wife and I and baptizing our oldest daughter. And so the Dominicans are very close to my heart, Don.
Me too. I was formed by Dominicans, and I write about Dominicans. I research on Dominicans, and they're just my favorite guys. And they're founded by one of my favorite saints, St. Dominic of Calaruega. He's a really attractive saint, but sometimes he's hard to approach as a saint. You know, we talked about St. Francis last week and how open and acceptable he is, how popular he is. Dominic's a different kind of character. Dominic's a difficult saint to get people excited about sometimes. He comes from Spain, a deeply Catholic country with a tradition of the Reconquest, that long struggle against Islam. And he receives, unlike Francis, a traditional church education. He becomes an Augustinian canon, and he's a close associate of Bishop Diego of Osma, who is a critical person for the foundation of the Dominican Order. He is a model reforming bishop, so he has taken care of his diocese, he's raised the level of education, he's purified the liturgy, he's done everything that he needs to do. But Bishop Diego may have one downside, and that is he's got a wanderlust. Once he does his things inside his own diocese, he wants to get out. He wants to go out and see the world. He wants to go out and be a missionary. And on these journeys, he'll take the young Dominic with him. Dominic was his closest associate. And so for the Royal Court of Spain, he went to Denmark to arrange a marriage for the court, for the king. And on the way there, they had to pass over the Pyrenees through Provence, through southern France, what is southern France today. And there, for the first time, they encountered heretics. They encountered Cathar dualists. For the first time, there weren't any heretics in Spain. And so Dominic stayed at an inn, and he found out the innkeeper was a Cathar who believed that the material world was evil. And so stayed up all night discussing with him and debating with him, and finally converted him by the morning. And so he had a late night, too, just like Todd and Ellen last
time. Ah, yeah.
So he went, and he said, and he and Dominic, Diego and Dominic said, you know, after we finish this, we want to go and we want to become missionaries. And so after the mission to Denmark, they took a diversion, and diversions were one of Diego's favorite things. He loved making diversions, anything to avoid actually having to go back. And so he went to Rome, and they saw Pope Innocent III, and Diego said, I would like to resign my diocese and become a missionary to the pagans.
Hmm.
And the Pope turns and looks at him and says, Absolutely not. You are exactly the kind of person I need in the diocese.
Right.
You're a model bishop. And so Diego said, okay, you know, I have to obey the Pope. And so the Pope told me to go home. But the Pope didn't tell me how to go home. And so he took another serious diversion through southern France. And he met with the Cistercians. And he began, and he went through Provence. And he began to preach as he went along against the heretics. And there he met the papal delegates, the papal preachers, who were there trying to convert the Cathars back to the Catholic faith. And he noticed that there was a disjunction, that these papal preachers, they were good men. They were solid men. They were well-educated. But they were also powerful men. They were rich men. They carried with them, you know, baggage trains, and they had to have guards because it was dangerous. And the Cathars, on the other hand, had these preachers that were poor. They dressed in tatty robes. They went barefoot from town to town. And so when people saw that, even before they heard the words, they were tending to look to the heretics because of their example. And so Dominic and Diego said, well, we're going to match fire with fire. We are going to put off all of our ecclesiastical garb, all of our finery, wear simple robes, and walk from town to town. And once they did that, once their example accompanied their words, all of a sudden they started to get results. They knew that the Catholic faith could overpower the heretics, but it was this example that communicated it to the people. To their credit, the papal preachers followed this, and they began to see success. The Cathars didn't like this, and so they hatched a plot, and they actually killed one of the papal ambassadors.
Oh, my Lord.
They murdered him.
Oh, my Lord. Because there is something attractive about that asceticism. I mean, with holiness, right?
Well,
Dawn?
It feels authentic, I would think. That would be the first appearance.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We always know when somebody is walking the walk that they're talking, right? Nothing turns people off more than hypocrisy. And even the sense of hypocrisy that maybe, oh, because you're wealthy, you know, I don't really have to listen to you. But when you match word and example, this is exceptionally powerful. And so what they did was the King of France and the Pope, they called a crusade, and there was a very bitter war because the Cathars had grown too powerful, they'd grown too bold, they'd killed the papal ambassador. And so Dominic, Diego finally had to go back to his diocese eventually, where he died in 1208, leaving Dominic all by himself. Mm. It was Dominic who essentially cared for the spiritual needs of the people in the aftermath of the war, of this terrible war. And so he starts to attract followers. And the first followers he attracts are female. They're the daughters of these powerful Cathar families that wanted to convert to the Catholic faith. But once they did, they were cut off by their family. And so he set up a house for them at Truy. And so the Dominican order is unique in that the women's branch comes first.
Wow.
The women's branch is the first one that's founded. And men come to join Dominic.
I'm sorry to cut you off. About how old was St. Dominic when this was first happening, Don?
Dominic was just then in his mid-30s.
Okay.
He was in his mid-20s when he was accompanying Bishop Diego, but when he founds the first female monastery, he's about 32 or 33.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he's at the prime of life, and he begins to attract followers, and he said, look, what we need to do, what is needed here, is the creation of a permanent body of men, permanent preachers against heresy, people who will be formed in the Catholic faith in order to help these people. And this is sometimes hard for us to understand today. When Dominic sat in the inn and was saddened by the heresy of his host, what enkindled him was the love of soul. Mm. He knew that this man's willful heresy put him in danger of eternal perdition. And so he wants to preach against heresy, not because he hates heretics, not because he hates these people. He wants to do it absolutely out of love. That preaching against heresy is an act of love. It's charitable. And so what would you need? A body of men like this would be absolutely revolutionary in the church. What would it even look like? So the first thing they need is flexibility. All of the older orders, so when we think of the Benedictines and the Cistercians and the Norbertines, all of them are attached to a church. They're attached to a place. They're fixed. They're fixated. They're permanent. In fact, St. Benedict, in his rule, warns us against so-called wandering monks. And so this stability provided them, you know, order in their lives. But in the conditions of the 13th century, the rapidly changing conditions, you needed people that could move from place to place wherever there was a necessity, right? You don't want your army to stay always in its army base. Sometimes the army has to move to where the enemy's at.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, okay, first of all, we need to be unattached, which is new and radical. The second thing he says, in order to preach, we need to have the best education possible. And so we need to clear the field, as it were, of all these religious and civil and domestic obligations so as to make education the primary end of this order.
Wow.
And so how are we going to do that? What he does is he creates a set of constitutions. And Dominic, in this sense, while he's often paired with St. Francis, he was Francis's opposite in that he was an administrative genius. His Dominican constitutions are one of the masterpieces of legislation, I think, in the history of humanity.
Wow.
They
That's
are
bold.
A...
Yeah,
that is
strong,
bold,
Don.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Well, first of all, it balances democracy and aristocracy. It allows the common members of the order a vote, and both the aristocratic element, that is the professors and the preachers, they have a certain amount of influence, but each can check the other. So checks and balances on either of those while giving each a voice, that's pretty advanced.
Wow.
He focuses on education. He frees the friars from adherence to a certain church or a certain monastery. And he says nothing should get in the way of education. And that includes dispensation from almost all of the old monastic jobs. And that includes not only even attendance in choir. And so, for instance, if you're a scholar, and this Thomas Aquinas actually benefited from this, you don't have to go to the office. You can say your office privately. You don't even have to attend the community mass. You can say your mass privately. Nothing, anything that will get you back to your study and get you back to the classroom faster, for the charitable sake, not for, you know, learning for its own sake, but so that you can learn in order to be a preacher.
Wow.
One of the greatest Dominican, the first Dominican cardinal said that before, that you must bend the bow in education before the arrow is released in preaching. And that's a really good example of the Dominican order.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that is beautiful.
So this was radical. So this was quite the change from how communities and orders had been developed, right?
But did they get the numbers, Don? I mean, did men start joining?
Well, what Dominic does is he sets up his priories in the university towns. And so the Dominicans are growing along with the university. They don't attract the same number of people as the Franciscans, but what they do is attract professors and students by the dozens and then by the hundreds. And so they begin to become moving forces in the university town. So they're urban, they're university-directed, they're academic, and they are intended for deployment in pastoral, immediate pastoral necessity. And, Ellen, yeah, this is really radical. This is really new. Up until now, you had a division of labor. There were the monasteries in the country, and you had the secular priests in the city. The secular priests were being overwhelmed at this time, too, by the urbanization. So many people moving in that they couldn't handle it. Not only that, they couldn't handle the numbers. They couldn't handle the heretics that were showing up because there was no formal clerical education. And so the Dominicans were really the first ones to form their members academically and for preaching in the world, for preaching against heresy, defending the faith. And so they become the greatest, in my opinion, right? The greatest intellectual order that the church has ever produced.
And then at what point in time did the Albigensians come on the scene?
Well, they were the Cathars that we're talking about. The innkeeper was probably an Albigensian. They make it even then in the town of Albi. So they were in the heart of this country. They were the Cathars, and the Dominicans are the primary reason why there's, you know, why Catharism disappeared.
Right.
They don't exist anymore.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's so good. Did he have the same kind of struggles that Francis had when, you know, in the infancy of this order?
Well, he definitely had struggles, but his were different, right? Because he was such an administrative genius. The problem for us is actually sort of accessing Dominic's personality. a great leader, a great administrator, you kind of lose them in the greatness of the foundation, the institution that they create. And so, because, you know, it's difficult to, you know, it's exciting to say, oh, Francis is, you know, patron of animals or something like that. But to say, oh, well, St. Dominic is patron saint of administrative affairs, that doesn't exactly fire the heart with brazen charity.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
But we need those saints. Just like we need Francis, we need Dominic. And that's why the two, I think, are so well paired, that they found orders that remove the obstacles necessary to reach people's hearts, that they help to remove, that they abandon this life of material possessions, they abandon the stability of life in order to go out into the neighborhoods, into the towns and byways, and actually meet people where they are, and to meet heretics and confront them out of love for souls and love for people.
That's beautiful.
It's funny, but when I think about Dominicans today, I think more of preachers. I never knew they were known to be good administrators, too. So that kind of seems to have fallen by the wayside a little bit. Because what do you think of when you think of Dominicans? Preachers.
No, I think preachers. Professors.
Oh, professors, too.
Professors?
Yeah.
Well, here's a hint of why you might not have heard them. They are the only order never to have their constitutions reformed. They are still using the same constitution from 800 years ago.
Wow.
Whoa.
Uh-huh. No tweaking needed.
Wow.
Well, no, I mean, Dominic gives a mechanism for, you know, in case, you know, new legislation is needed. But the core of the constitution, just like our constitution has amendments, but the core of the constitution remains.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Don Prudilo, I always learn something when he comes on.
Of course.
Yeah.
We got a certificate.
Good stuff. Thanks, Don. You have an awesome week. We will talk to you next Thursday.
Thanks. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Don.
Oh, coming up next, Dr. Bridget Hanahan. She's coming in studio. Look at that. We're going to talk about how to find a child psychologist. Or maybe a psychologist for your child. She's going to fill us in on that.
Oh, my Lord, of course. That's
okay, just say it. LA Catholic Morning continues.
My heart lives by the thing.
Love this.
I know, it's good stuff. Producing like a boss over there. Welcome back to LA Catholic Morning here on Archangel Radio. I'm Todd Sylvester with Ellen Taylor.
Yes.
Great. Doing his thing. The Ripster. Pushing buttons over there. And in studio, Dr. Bridget Hanahan, regular guest on the show, here to speak to us about choosing a child therapist. Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess the first question that people would have is, does my child need a child therapist?
You know, Todd, you can read my mind. That was an excellent question.
Look, you got a printout.
Here, Ellen.
Look at that. She comes like a teacher prepared.
That is a great question, because a lot of times, you know, kids are the canary in the coal mine, so they may demonstrate issues that need attention, but it may really be a family problem or maybe a school problem. And so that's a really important question. So
how do we figure it out then?
Well, I mean, if your child has anxiety or depression or behavior that's interfering with school or that's interfering with their friendships or ability to form friendships, that's a reason to consult with a professional. If they have changes in their eating habits or their sleeping habits, you know, that are really outside the norm of, you know, just temporary issues, that would be a reason. So basically, you know, you look for impairment, like if they're not doing their life like they need to be doing their life.
I like that, doing their life.
Right.
Well, during COVID, though, I mean, that just threw a wrench into everybody's life, it seems, huh?
Mm-hmm. Heartbreaking for me to see because, they were taken all outside. And then a lot of therapists moved online, which is really not helpful for kids, especially if they've been staring at a screen all day anyway with school. And
has that gotten a little bit more back to normal? In person?
More.
Okay.
All right.
That's
so,
good.
So let's say that we do kind of assess and go, all right, we're thinking that we're in the spectrum of the possibility of our child needs a child therapist.
Yeah. And I forgot to mention the third thing is if the child's behavior is affecting the marriage or if it's affecting the siblings, that's another reason to go for professional help, right? Because you're going to see issues all around.
All right. So then what do we do? Do we just Google this?
You can. Uh-huh. Yeah. And a lot of people do, but I don't think that's necessarily the best way. So it's kind of, I was thinking about, it's like an analogy to dating, right? right? Like, how do you meet the best people? Well, when you know good people and you talk to them and they go, oh, I know this person. And I mean, sometimes it bombs, right? It's not a good fit, but at least it's, you know, that kind of they've been vetted by someone that you trust and know. So that's the best way. But people don't go around saying, hey, my kid went to a psychologist, and if you need one, I can hook you up. Because they're private about it, especially if they are people of discretion and good, you know, will. They don't want to, you know, ruin their child's, you know, image with other folks, so they're just going to keep that private. But if you say something about it and you say, hey, and you don't even have to say which kid, right? For you, Todd, it would be very confidential.
One of them.
If you have an only child, then you're really in trouble.
Possibly one of my children.
Well, and if you do have an only child, you can be discreet by saying, hey, I know a kid that's really struggling. You know, I intimately know this kid because they're in my house, but you don't have to say that. You can just say, hey, I know somebody that's really, you know, having trouble with their kid. And I mean, it's kind of that classic thing, right? Hey, my friend has this issue with their kid. And you can do that.
I know, but I'm just horrible with discretion. I'm the worst. I'm the worst on the planet.
It's a good thing you have the 10 kids.
I guess, yeah, because we've had difficulties with some of our kids.
And, sure you have.
And we have one child right now who is seeing a therapist, and it's wonderful. And they're giving them a tremendous skill set and tools to deal with their anxiety.
And, I mean, I'm glad you're talking about it. And it's gotten much more common for people to feel comfortable talking about it because it's just part of normal life. I mean, you have kids. You have kids with problems. I mean, everyone has problems.
Right.
So it's just very normal. And I think the more we can normalize it and people can feel comfortable going, hey, you know, we're struggling.
I think everyone's struggling during this time, and I can imagine that for kids that don't, you know, you expect certain things, and things just are not as we imagine them. So I don't think it's there's I almost feel like the, a little bit element of shame has gone away from it just because we want to make sure we captured this problem early so it does not lead to another decade of problems post-pandemic if we ever get there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Ellen. And the pandemic restrictions have hit kids worse than anyone else because if you think about it, I mean, if they had 18 months out of school, that is a huge portion of their lifetime. And it makes it seem, you know, for us, it's very inconvenient and it's troubling. But, you know, if it's been like all of your life that you can pretty much remember, which is kind of how they are, right? They're very in the present and the recent past. Then it's much more troubling and it feels much more unsettling.
Ironically, we were inspired more so because of one of our older kids who said, listen, I see this younger sibling that's going through a lot of the same things that I did, and it would be really helpful for them to get these tools now.
Yeah, I see that a lot. And it's great when siblings are close enough and caring enough and informed enough to say, hey, this is, you know, something you need help with.
We had a tremendous experience. I mean, it was just wonderfully positive all the way through.
So how did you find your person?
Well, you know, and your name even came up.
Oh, look at that.
Because we started networking. We started just making inquiries, just like you're talking about. And there were people that we trusted. And certain individuals in, who have a lot of little initials after their names. And I was like, well, who do you recommend? And they've said so-and-so and so-and-so. And they said, the only reason why this would be nice is you wouldn't have to cross the bay.
Well, good. Yeah. I do have a satellite location in Daphne.
There you go.
So what should parents look for if they're looking for a therapist for their kids?
You know, you want it depends on the age of your kid, right? Okay. You want it to be kid friendly because, I mean, just because you like the therapist's office doesn't mean that your kid's going to feel comfortable there. So, you know, look for do they have a playroom or at least an area or at least a dedicated, you know, collection of toys and books that are age appropriate. I use a lot of bibliotherapy with kids. It was one of my favorite things when my kids were little was to read to them. And so I just, I love to curate, you know, a collection of books that are therapeutic. And there's tons of them now that are really good. So look for that. And that would be an important kind of way to start engaging for the therapist to start engaging. And then, you know, just like anything, you want to look at their education and qualifications. So what are you looking for? You're right. There's tons of initials and they all mean different things. And so, you know, you want to know that the person's licensed, obviously. But most of the people that are credentialed are. And then, you want to know, like, what is their background in child development? And it doesn't have to mean that they had a specialty, clinical child psychology program that they participated in, or an internship even in that, but they have some experience. So it may be professional experience, that's best, right? It's very helpful. But also it may be somebody like you, if you were a psychologist and you had your kids and you've like been through like tons of experience and you know kind of, oh, this is normal and this is not. And that helps a lot. But if they have the specialized degree and experience, it's really helpful because that person can quickly identify, hey, this is a problem with your kid, this is a problem with the parenting, or it's a combination, which is more common. Or your kid's normal and you just are anxious about what's going on because you're going through this situation or you're worried and, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Now, some parents, I think, have reservations because they're concerned that the individual, because I know there's a difference between a therapist, psychologist, and a psychiatrist. Yes. I think they're worried about medication.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you go to a psychiatrist, they're going to probably give your child medication because that's what they do, right? I mean, mm-hmm. and they assume that if you're walking in their door, that's what you're looking for. And but there is some confusion about it because so a psychiatrist is a medical professional and they prescribe. Now, there are also some nurse practitioners, and they also are probably going to be focused on prescription because they have that ability. They have the power of the pen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they can give you and your child relief. Even if the medication hasn't taken effect yet, it's a huge relief to have a prescription and go, okay, this is going to make my kid feel better. This is going to help us, you know. And so, but keep that in mind. You know, it's not the psychiatrist's fault if you go in and then, oh, they want to put my kid on medication. Yeah, that's what they do, right? That's what they know. And then, of course, the therapist is going to think therapy is the answer. And, I'm biased that way. And but I do. And that's where the psychopathology training comes in, because I'm also able to recognize I can't get anywhere with this child until they have some relief from their anxiety that's crippling, then preventing them from engaging with me, with anybody else. And so there are many times where I say, OK, we've tried a few sessions. We're not getting anywhere. Let's consult with medication and see if we can.
Mm-hmm. How does it work with the parents' expectations? The benefit of having so many children is I just realize how messy life is.
Absolutely.
And having to deal with things. It's like sometimes you would come home and your teenage daughter's crying and mm-hmm. what's wrong? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
So it's like trying to, our expectations though, I think now we've been set up with culture with everything comes so instantaneously that we really expect if I bring my child to one session to you, Dr. Hanahan, that they're going to walk out and they're going to be holistic and fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, I usually set that up in the beginning. So number one, when I first engage with a family, I meet with the parents, both parents, whether they're divorced or not divorced. I meet with the two of them together alone without the kid. So that kind of sets it off like, hey, you're really an important part of this process. And there are some therapists that will work just with the kid. They'll close the door. They'll go in. And you don't know what they're doing. I mean, and you seem they're doing nice things. You've got toys and books and mm-hmm. whatever. But as a parent, you need to know. And a lot of times, I mean, probably 90% of the time, I want the parent in the room with me while I'm working with a kid, because I want them to see what I'm doing. If there's any value in what I'm doing, then I want the parent to watch that and begin to do that too. And so anyway, that's my expectation is that the parents can be an integral part of that.
Have you seen a change? Because you've been at this for a long time.
A change in
just behavior of kids nowadays? I mean, because I don't know. I've seen just kind of a wave of more anxiety, and it seems be striking
yes.
kids when they're younger.
Oh, absolutely. The anxiety is just rampant. And
there's a lot of studies coming out about social media use and bringing on anxiety, particularly this week. Just there was one story focusing particularly on Instagram and the effect mm-hmm. on young girls. And it seems to me that we see it out there, but we're unable to recognize and do something actively about the problem too. Do you see that this social media interaction is causing a lot of issues?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That, for teens and sometimes younger, if they have access to it, it does create a lot of, it creates anxiety. And, for a lot of time, long time it was hard to see that. It's like, well, maybe it's just the kids that are more anxious, they watch, they, you know, they participated in it more. The kids that are already isolated, they're on Instagram more. No, they become more isolated, they become more anxious, they become more depressed. And there are some studies now that have shown that. And I'm so happy that the Wall Street Journal put out a series on Facebook and Instagram. And I think that pressure that they got from the Wall Street Journal was what caused Facebook, Instagram to say, hey, we're going to abandon this app specifically for kids.
Right. Well, they were, and if our listeners don't know, Facebook was ready to launch an Instagram for the under 13-year-olds. Yep. And there was a lot of pushback because why? You know, why are you doing this and why are we allowing this to their children? Mm-hmm. There was one commentator that said, you know, we knew Marlboros were bad at some point for the health of our children, and we took that out of society because we said that is not good for our children, and we have to make these same kind of choices when it comes to social media and not be influenced by big tech and the large amounts of monies that are being made off the data and the use of our kids in this. We really, really have to be mindful.
Some of the parents are probably listening right now thinking, okay, I don't know if my kids necessarily need a therapist, but I would like to create an environment that kind of shores them up against possibly needing that in the future. What do you recommend to them?
Wow, that's a great question. Do you have another 20 minutes?
Here's my book.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's why I work with parents, too, because you know, in terms of anxiety and depression, yeah, there's environmental things going on and things we can't change. But you're right. Some people are more resilient. Some people have done well during the pandemic. Some people are thriving. Most of those people are introverts, but still.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But yeah, so I want the parents in the room because I do cognitive behavioral therapy with kids. I do that with everybody pretty much, unless they have grief or something that is really a life event that is not. Because of how they're thinking.
Right.
It doesn't help. I'm spinning my wheels if I'm teaching the kid how to think differently and the parent is still speaking to them in the way that they're speaking in their head. And that's usually the case, right? I mean, we learn those messages from our parents and they're well-intended, you know, should statements and, you know, you never do this. And so I want the parent sitting right there when we're doing the fun activities and we're learning about different ways that are, you know, better to talk to ourselves. Then I want them there because that's like 100 times more powerful than if I'm just working with the kid.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You got to change the whole environment too.
And parents, I mean, they like it. They pick up on it quickly and they're like, oh, okay, you know, and they start correcting themselves. And then the kids, I mean, kids are so, they bounce back. If the parents, you know, if the family environment, the home environment's good, they are really resilient.
Mm-hmm.
That's so
good.
Wow.
Dr. Bridget Hanahan, love the work you're doing, looking out for our kids. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing that.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, always good to see you in studio. Well, coming up next, Todd, Blogosphere.
Yeah, baby.
We're going to talk about some things. I think I found something slightly positive for you, but then something's going to make you think. So stick with us here.
Thanks for that.
On LA Catholic Morning.
Home is where the heart is, and my heart lives by the bay. Home is where the heart is, and my heart lives by the bay. Cause everybody cries. Everybody hurts.
Mike, it's not everybody, it's just Todd crying.
What do you mean just Todd? Give me
just
a break.
Todd.
Yeah, I'm the only one that ever reaches for a tissue. You guys are all pathetic. You know
you're
that?
Just the only one that mentions it.
Okay, all right. Oh, you're the only one that's honest.
So Thursday, Blogosphere, and there's always, again, every time I open the news, Todd, it's too much information.
Well, it's because you get on Twitter. I mean,
yeah,
get off Twitter.
That is, no, that is my secret weapon to figure out what's going on in the world. Anyway, I was talking separately to some different people this week involved in the church, one a priest and one a just very active lay person. And both of them kind of, when I dug down to the conversation, there's a common thread that everybody around them seems to be angry, frustrated, or annoyed mostly on a daily basis these days.
Okay.
And so
that sounds really pleasant.
Yeah, I know. Life has just been ratcheting up our emotions. And so in thinking about that, we forget who we're made for and who we're made by God the Creator, and what we're supposed to do. We're not supposed to live our life in frustration, annoyance, and anxiety. So I thought, well, why are we here, and are we forgetting certain basic tenets to our Christian faith and how to act to each other in a Christian way? Because that certainly doesn't happen. We spend all day arguing points and procedures and trying to gain real estate in our argument with people, and it has nothing really to do with our salvation. So I came across a great article on BustedHalo.com called How to Keep Your Faith When You're Just Not Feeling It, because I think a lot of us just aren't feeling it these days. And it had some good points that I wanted to share. So the writer just talks about how he felt like he was just dry and not losing it. In our Catholic faith, we might call it spiritual desolation and stuff like that. It'd be very unnerving and confusing. So he had points that I thought were important to just kind of remind people. Let's get back to basics. Pray even when you don't feel like it. Mm. Praying when you don't feel like it is quite virtuous. It keeps us grounded in what we need to do. Even if you think you're not getting anything out of it, you're getting something out of it. You're extending your heart into a discomfortable zone, if you will. So we need to do that. Grow in knowledge and you'll grow in love. So sometimes we can't feel it. And there's a thing we have when people sometimes are converted, reading themselves into the faith. That go back to that basic step. And when you're in a drought and you can't feel it, focus on maybe the intellectual side. Because by reading the Bible or studying the catechism or talking to other faithful people about it, you're going to grow in knowledge, then your heart's going to be softened a little bit, and you might take a step further from this path of anger and annoyance that you're on. The other one is turn your faith into action. So we don't feel like doing it, but maybe making a meal for a family member on a weekend, maybe doing a little bit extra chore, maybe those basic steps we learn in the simplest form of our Christian faith of doing something for others will get you out of that moment and out of yourself and out of that annoyance factor you're feeling.
That's beautiful.
The last one is continue to make the sacraments. You know, we hear it often, particularly with young people. I don't get anything out of Mass. Well, be there anyway. Your presence, just sitting there, even if you feel you come out of Mass and you're like, well, I didn't really concentrate on anything. You're going to get the grace of the sacrament of attending Holy Mass, receiving Holy Communion, that is edifying to your soul and soothing. And you may not feel it. You may not even think you felt it, but you felt it. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to have repercussions out in your life. So I thought these were just simple steps to remind people that you don't have to spend your day annoyed and frustrated. There are things, if we go back to the basics and remember who we are, Christians, and what we're called to do and to be in this world, that'll help us out of these frustrating daily situations that we're in.
I just think having the right attitude is the best thing, and having that perspective. Last night, I saw an individual at the dinner,
right?
And I haven't seen them in months and months. And I said, oh, you look great. And he says, well, this fantastic thing happened today. I was like, oh, what? He says, I woke up. And I mean, you know, they're kind of half joking, but I'm like, wow, that really is a good perspective to recognize that God gifted us with life that day. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that is an entitlement. I mean, we don't deserve that. I woke up this morning, my eyes opened, and I'm still breathing.
Healthy. And everything else on top of that is a gift.
Amen.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up another article I saw, because we get hit with so many news articles that it's hard. You can really miss things, and things that are important, or maybe things that need our attention. And I saw this one in McCaternet.net, and I thought this really is something that is going to pass people by, and we really need to be mindful of it. So they had an article of why U.S. nursing homes are giving fake schizophrenia diagnosis to the elderly. So
well, that sounds sad.
It is very sad. So many nursing homes are all of a sudden diagnosing many of their elderly patients with schizophrenia. And if anyone knows, schizophrenia is usually a disease that is diagnosed by a person in their early 20s. It's very rare that someone gets this later in life. So what they're seeing is that residents in nursing homes, schizophrenia diagnoses soared 70% since 2012. And that's an unheard of rise, especially when it's a disease not found in people in the nursing home age. So we have to ask ourselves, well, why is this happening? So FDA studies have looked at it, some studies on the elderly have looked for it. And what they found is that many times in nursing homes, especially during this pandemic, there's been a shortage of workers. I think nursing homes have lost like 380,000 workers in their field since the pandemic.
Wow.
I mean, that is an enormous number. So what's happening is, in order to still handle patients, nursing homes are tending to medicate. And medicate or incapacitate, as it may be, in many ways, in order so they can still keep their, you know, the reports and the figures that come out by their nursing homes. Because once they put people on medications, then they get moved. If they get diagnosed as schizophrenia, then they come kind of out of their numbers as how many patients we're medicating or how many patients are working for staff. It's a very switcheroo way with the numbers. So if they're over here in the schizophrenia column, we can take them out of this column.
So wait, if they diagnose them with schizophrenia, then what happens?
Well, then they're allowed to give them medication to control it. So it's very cruel. Back in 1987, President Reagan banned the use of medications that serve the interests of staff and nursing homes for this very reason. That if you put someone into the category and medicate them. But they've been using this loophole as a way to, in many times, subdue dementia patients, too. Because, and that is really
sad. So schizophrenia medications, what does it do to someone?
I would imagine in different age groups, it does different things. I'm not a medical doctor.
Right.
I can say that they use it in order to subdue patients that might just have dementia or might need more attention than they have the staff for.
Yeah.
That's what these studies and this article in MercatorNet seems to be implying. So one of the things is this abuse of medication in order to control the group in the nursing home because you're understaffed.
Yeah.
In the same extent, we see it in childhood with so many more children have been medicated over the past few years with ADHD and ADD. And it's kind of the same principle, but just in a small person. We're going to medicate them to put them in the classroom. So, and a lot of parents have mentioned about the overuse of medication for children, too. So it's not just something going on with our elderly. It's something going on with our kids. And we really need to take a look at society as medication to numb people the proper way to help them. But that's a story for a different day.
Yeah.
So we have all this. We have the issue of when COVID struck too, nursing homes were locked down. Family members weren't able to come. You had staff that had to be on call for their residents in the nursing home 24/7, whereas in the past, maybe a family member would come in and handle something or spend time with them. So you had all this, and this has raised serious concerns about the safety and the viability of many of these institutions. We're not even talking about the ones that got COVID. I mean, that's a whole different story. So this policy, from a broader sense of people of faith, we talk about respect for life, from the preborn all the way to the elderly. And we can't let something like this be overlooked, that our parents and grandparents that we think are in places that are being cared for might actually just be being medicated, and we can't get in to see the oversight. So I think we have to be diligent in finding these situations, particularly in our own families, and then calling them out on it. There was even after World War II, the United Nations put this concept in their Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person, even the oldest people. So we have to help them in their security of person, that they are not going to be medicated in order to just subdue them and make them docile so we can all get along with living our lives and house them in some place. So
yeah, but we also have to take into consideration the difficulties that some of these people are going through. I'm not sanctioning what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But my wife did work in a nursing home and the struggles, I remember coming to pick her up at the end of her shifts. And sometimes some of the residents would run for the door. And that, I mean, that's a struggle.
Right, but there's a difference there between that and diagnosing somebody with schizophrenia when they're 80s or 90s and medicating them up, you know.
I agree.
To the point.
I agree, because some of the people, they look comatose. I mean, they were sitting in their in their wheelchairs, and you didn't even know if they were still breathing.
Right.
I mean,
when the diagnosis for schizophrenia in elderly has risen 70% in the last decade.
We know something's wrong.
We know something's wrong,
but it's like, how do you deal with the issue? Just like everything that you just said, they're understaffed. You can't get workers, and yet you still have all these residents. So what do you do? I don't want to medicate them. I don't want to strap them down either. I would love families to be allowed back in the building so that they can help the situation, because we're a culture that we don't care for our elderly in our own homes, really, generally, anymore.
Bing, bing, maybe we have a problem. I mean, maybe we've lost our way. This generation, that the baby boomer generation, and we were really taught to leave your hometown, go out, make your way in the world, and people want and raise their families and found their work maybe far, far away places across the country from where their parents are now aging and residing.
Right.
So you have to come back to, these are hard choices made individually by families every day. But God never promised us that all of our choices were going to be easy.
Amen.
And we were never promised that it wasn't going to take personal sacrifice to make these choices. So we have to decide, what are we willing to personally sacrifice for the love of our family? And that's going to be the hard choice. And I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying that's a solution for everybody's family, but we really need to look at ourselves.
I agree.
We really need to. So just keep an eye on your elderly, whether they're near or far from you. We have to do better by them. They did better by us.
Nice.
There we go. We thank our LA Catholic Morning sponsor, Caligaz Printing. For over 25 years, Caligaz has been Mobile's leading full-service commercial and digital printer. For great holiday ideas, visit Caligaz t-shirt brand, Finns Apparel, at finnsapparel.com. That's P-H-I-N-S apparel.com. Thanks again so much for listening to LA Catholic Morning. We hope you have a blessed day and a beautiful Thanksgiving. Enjoy the time with your family. God bless you all, and be sure to join us tomorrow for another Best of LA Catholic Morning.